Recordings have started.
Okay, thank you. Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Next Generation RDS-PDP Working Group call on the 1st of August, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Thank you. Hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid background noise. And with this, I'll turn it back over to our chair, Chuck Ohms.
Thanks, Julie, and welcome, everyone. Let me start by asking if there are any updates to statement of interest. Alan, please.
Thank you. Just to let the group know, I'm a member of the RDS Who Is review team and interim chair.
Thank you very much, and congratulations, Alan, for the chair position. So,
one could question whether it's congratulations.
Maybe condolences, whatever. But I'm appreciate you taking the responsibility. Okay. Anyone else? All right, thank you very much. Let's go ahead and move right into our agenda, get our work moving here. So the first item on our agenda is to continue our deliberation beyond the minimum public data set. And the main charter question is what data should be collected, stored, and disclosed, although really all we're looking at is collection right now. The first thing we're going to do is to take a look at our poll results from last week's poll. And we had about 22 people respond to the poll, thanks to those of you who did. And it provided quite a lot of good information. You can see that, see who responded on the page in front of you. And in a moment, we should have scrolling. We should all have scrolling capability. So in the meantime, there we go. Okay, if you go down to question two, we'll start there. And if you look at the results for question two, we had a pretty strong support. 82% agreed with the key concept: RDS policy must include a definition of every GTLD registration data element, including both a semantic definition and, by reference to appropriate standards, a syntax definition. Now, we had quite a bit of talk on the list and in our meeting last week on the syntax. Hopefully, the parenthetical covers that enough, at least for now. And I certainly understand why a few people weren't sure, because it was a fairly involved discussion on the syntax and so forth, so that's okay. So unless anyone wants to comment, and you can see the comments and the proposed alternatives there, my suggestion on this one is that we accept it as a tentative key concept with at least rough consensus at this point in time, understanding that we can always come back to it. And so I'll pause, see if anybody wants to comment. If any of you want to push for your proposed alternatives a little bit further, you're welcome to do that. Otherwise, we'll just accept this one and move on to question number three. I do like the word crandolences, although I have trouble saying it. Okay, let's go on to question three then, if you'll scroll down to the results for that. And the key concept here is at least one element identifying the domain name registrant, i.e. registered name holder, must be collected and included in the RDS. Again, we had about 82% people in agreement with that. We had one person disagree, and that person's not on the call, so I can't turn to that person. One thing I would like to suggest for everybody, especially if you disagree, it would be very helpful if you provide your thinking on that, your rationale, so that rather than just disagreeing. And so I would like to encourage that of everybody. If you disagree, and you're of course welcome to do that, and you should do that if you disagree, but please put a comment on to explain why. Because the group's doing a lot of time talking about these things and so forth, and if you disagree with everybody in the group, it'd be nice to know why you do that. And so please follow that suggestion when you disagree. And again, I don't want to discourage anybody from disagreeing, but help us understand where you're coming from, and don't just rely on things. Please remember to mute your phones. Sounds like somebody just did, so thank you. Now, this, Mark, go ahead.
Hey, Chuck. Thanks to Mark Anderson for the record. On this one, I want to say, you know, I do agree with this statement. I think it's actually a very important key concept, but you know, I do want to just sort of point out or raise that, you know, in some cases the identifying information will be of a privacy or proxy provider. You know, and I think that's still within you know, the framework of what, you know, question three intends, but at least that's you know, sort of how I'm interpreting it. Thank you.
And thanks, Mark. And that's not only your interpretation. We've said that, I think, the last two meetings, that the domain name registrant may be a proxy provider. So that doesn't mean you're getting the actual user of the domain name when you see that. And we've accepted that as a working group. And so, but thanks for reminding everybody of that. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to go further on that. My understanding is when someone registers a domain name on your behalf and identifies themselves as the registrant, whether it's a privacy proxy provider or your lawyer, they're taking full responsibility for the domain. They may choose to reveal who the true registrant of you know, of interest is, should things come to pass, but regardless, they're taking responsibility to respond on behalf of whatever happens with that domain name. And I don't think that alters the fact that they are effectively the de facto registrant. So, yes, it might be a privacy service. It might be your lawyer. It might be your mother-in-law. But they're nevertheless the registrant of record and assume all the responsibilities. So I don't think we really need to differentiate, but we may want to define that clearly as we go forward. Thank you.
Yeah, and of course, the previous question, we said that all of these data elements need to be defined. But what you said is correct, Alan. And of course, as I think everyone knows, there's a recent consensus policy involving privacy and proxy providers that is being implemented or will be implemented. So some of those things will be dealt with, but what you said and what Mark said are absolutely correct. Any other comments on this key concept? Or does anybody want to talk about their proposed alternative? I think we have strong enough support here to declare a rough consensus, tentative key concept here. Mark, go ahead.
Hey, Chuck. It's Mark again. I'm not sure I agree with what Alan just said. I think there's a differentiation between a privacy registration and a proxy registration. And I think in a proxy registration, I agree with Alan's statement, but I think in a privacy registration, that's not meant to be the case.
That is correct, Mark. And I don't think Alan was trying to be that fine-tuned on it. In the case of a privacy registration, the privacy provider is not the registrant typically. So there is a difference there, but thanks for pointing that out. Any objections to accepting this key concept as a rough consensus conclusion at this stage of the game? Or any additional comments? Okay, let's go on then to question four. And the key concept there, if you scroll down to question four, is data enabling at least one way to contact the registrant must be collected and included in the RDS. We had one less person in this case agree. One person disagree, and we have several unsure, and that's okay because a lot of these things involve a lot of factors, so we certainly understand that. And it's even harder if you weren't on the call where we discussed some of these things, so that's the advantage of listening to the recording and looking at the transcript. So on this one, does anyone want to comment on any of the proposed alternatives or just share a comment on this one? Again, I think we have strong enough support at this stage of the game to accept it as a tentative conclusion. And if anybody objects to that, please let us know. Okay, let's go ahead and go to question five. And here we have a couple alternatives at least. And here we don't have as strong a conclusion on either one of the alternatives. So the first one, in green on your screen, is at minimum the registrant's email address must be collected and included in the RDS. And then the one in blue, and the bars are color-coded to match, at a minimum one or more email addresses must be collected for every domain name included in the RDS for contact roles that require an email address for contactability. We talked about this one quite a bit last week, and you can see that there were 12 people who supported A and 9 people supported B, and then 2 people disagree with this key concept. And Klaus, I'm going to pick on you, apologize, but I'm going to do it. Could you explain why you disagree with this key concept?
Hi, can you hear me? Yes, this is Klaus for the record. Quite simply because I think there are much better or other ways to contact people. And for example, what happened to me quite recently is that the email provider just simply packed it in, and I had to stop using a certain email, and I can't even go back into certain email settings to delete the old email. So I think there should be quite simply other alternatives available for registration for a registration than email. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Klaus, and that's very helpful. That's why it's good when you disagree to put your rationale in there, and that's perfect. What you said, I readily understand. Now, I would propose that even if we require an email address or possibly more than one email address, that doesn't prevent us from allowing for other means of contact, and we have another key concept that's coming up that deals with that. But thanks, Klaus. That's very helpful, certainly to me. Michele.
Thanks, Michele, for the record. The wording of the proposal is at a minimum. So we're not saying in this that other contact methods aren't going to be collected or available or used. So in the case of email, yeah, emails go stale. One of the largest providers of free email in the Irish market decided a few years to stop offering service. So overnight, thousands and thousands of domains and other services that were using email addresses at that provider ceased operating. As a registrar, we have people's phone numbers and other methods of contacting them. So, you know, you can still ring people, you can still send them text messages, you can still contact them using other means, which is why I have no issue with the idea expressed here that it's at minimum. We're not saying it's the only method of contact.
Thanks, Michele. Mark, go ahead.
Thanks, Chuck. Mark Anderson for the record. I like email. That's my favorite form of communication. And, on last week's call, I think a lot of people made points on why email is certainly at this time the most practical method. I'm concerned that we're basically making a requirement here that says you can't have a domain name unless you have an email address, and that makes me slightly uncomfortable. I feel like there are other perfectly legitimate methods of contacting people, and so I'm not entirely convinced that email must be a prerequisite to buying a domain name, and that's sort of why I'm a little hesitant on this one. I'm not convinced that email should be mandatory for a registration. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Rod, you're up.
Thanks, Rod Rasmussen. I'd actually like to respond directly to what Mark was just saying there. I think that, and that's why I was the one who proposed the alternative language there. And that is, you personally don't necessarily have to have an email as a registrant. That's why the wording was chosen somewhat carefully, I hope, to say the roles that require an email. Because we have a lot of automated processes and policy today, and I'm not sure the practicalities of changing all of that policy and practice, what those would be in order to do things like domain transfers, other sorts of update processes, et cetera, that are baked into a lot of different things. So I think that if you have an issue with not having an email yourself, you may be able to designate other contacts that do have email to be able to handle those processes. And we don't know that's another reason for the wording the way it is. We may come up with going through this process, may go through this and find that we don't have to necessarily require it at all. But if we are going to have email for the processes that exist and we think are going to continue to exist in order to make this whole domain ecosystem work, then at least some role has to have it, not necessarily the registrant. Thanks.
Thanks, Rod. This is Chuck. With that understanding, Mark, I'm going to come back to you just briefly. Your point's well taken that some people, especially the wording in A, kind of requires an email address to do a domain registration, and B still does in the sense that one may be provided, but Rod's right, the way this is worded, and he helped us word it, it doesn't necessarily mean that the person has to, the registrant themselves has to have an email address, but they would have to provide one that would work if a communication came via email. Does that make you any more comfortable, Mark?
Hey, Chuck, Mark again. Yeah, I typed in chat that, you know, it does. I mean, you know, I think people made very good points last week. Things like domain transfers, email is just sort of baked into that process. And, you know, I don't think we should take on trying to change those processes. I think that's beyond our scope. So there's some very practical reasons why email should be involved. And, you know, just listening to Rod talk, you know, sort of, you know, addressed my hesitation, I guess.
Thanks, Mark. McKaylee, go ahead.
Thanks, McKaylee, for record. I'm going to have to disagree because one of the problems for us when we are trying to sell digital services, you know, email, website hosting, office, you know, business collaboration services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is at this stage you're reaching more and more towards the small businesses that may not have active email at present. In some cases you might end up taking sign-ups using some other method other than email. Now, having email further down the road when the domain is active or within a couple of weeks of the domain being active, sure, which would address all the things around transfers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not 100% convinced that forcing people to have an email address at the time that they're registering a domain name should be a prerequisite.
So, McKaylee, would you not accept either A or B the way they're worded?
Well, see, it's all around timing, Chuck. So the thing is this, if the way it's worded at the moment, we're talking about collecting and storing the data. We're not saying when.
So back to my question, are you okay with A or B, the way they're worded?
Oh, yeah, no, I am. I mean, and my position on that isn't going to change. But the thing is, I mean, we did a project a couple of years ago, and the market we were targeting were, you know, these kind of small businesses who are disconnected. And, you know, they all will have mobile phones. Now, if you go into, say, the you know, into developing markets, people will have mobiles. They'll have other things. I mean, you might be physically actually interacting and taking sign-ups from people in person. The assumption that they're going to have email is something that, you know, they might have it further down the line. And realistically, in terms of managing domain names, when they move from using their freebie Hotmail or whatever it is, email address, to using their at their business name dot whatever, a lot of the time they don't maintain the old Hotmail thing, so you end up with the contactability issue. So realistically speaking, having them actually using an email address that they're actually using actively is probably better in the long run. Thanks.
Thank you, Makeda. That answered my question. Appreciate that. Alan, you're up.
Thank you. I sympathize with what McKaylee is saying, that there are markets where email may not be something that is that they can claim they have at the time of registration. I don't know if it fits here or not, but I wonder if we should at some point consider whether we wish to allow the email contacts that we use to be the domain that is being registered. That's done in an awful lot of cases, but it's really problematic if the domain stops working and there's no contact information available at that point that actually functions. So I'd just perhaps put it on a checklist of things to look at as we go forward. Thank you.
Alan, this is Chuck. I need you to explain what you're suggesting, because I
sure.
don't understand.
If I register alangreenberg.com and I use me at alangreenberg.com as my contact, if that domain for some technical reason stops working, the contact information also stops working.
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay. Thanks. And were you making a suggestion, a specific suggestion for another action on our part, or just pointing that out?
I'm suggesting that we should consider whether we want to allow that or not. Allowing it is clearly a good thing when we're looking at the small businesses that Michaela is talking about, and they will ultimately only have one electronic persona, and that's the domain they're registering. On the other hand, it does cause potential problems in using that contact information when there are issues.
This is Chuck again. To use a personal example, if you don't allow it, my two emails don't work. So, I think there might be a lot of people like that.
Yeah, I'm just giving the two sides and simply saying we should make a conscious
yeah.
decision. It may well be a bad idea to disallow it, but I think we should make a conscious decision, not think about what the implications are.
Okay. Michaeli, go ahead.
Thanks, Michaeli, for record. I mean, I understand exactly where Alan's coming from. So to put what Alan's talking about into clearer kind of terms, I suppose, what he's concerned about is if you have, we'll pick on Alan, so we'll use alan.ca. So Alan has god at alan.ca, daddy at alan.ca, whatever he has at .ca, and he's using that for everything. If the domain name expires or there's an issue with the domain name, then everything associated with it, including the contacts and everything else that the registrar and everybody else would have, all die with it. But, of course, then you've got the scenario where, for example, in a more corporate environment, you're not going to use a free whatever email address. At some point, you're going to have to use your corporate email address for various things. I mean, I have no issue with pointing out the risks with using, I think Andrew used the very correct term, in Ballywick email. There are risks associated with that, and having an alternative contact email address somewhere, be that in RDS, who is the registrar, whatever, makes perfect sense. But forbidding people from using their own domain name to provide the email address that for the contacts for their domain would cause all sorts of crazy problems. I mean, I just don't see that flying. Thanks.
Thanks, Michaeli. And Alan, thanks for bringing up this point. What I'm going to suggest, so that we don't try to do it on this call, is that, Alan, if you would propose a new key concept with regard to this issue, and we can work on it on the list and then possibly add it to our discussions in the meeting next week. But thanks for bringing that up. Take a look at the comments in the chat as well. I'm going to ask a question. If I look at A and B, it seems to me, and I'm going to ask especially for those who supported A and not B, it seems to me if we accepted B as a rough consensus key concept at this point in time, for the most part, it really covers A. But I want to give opportunity for those who chose A instead of B, and there were actually more of you that did that. Would you be opposed to that, and why? So, Alan, go ahead.
Thank you. I didn't participate in this poll. I was on vacation and didn't get around to it. But I strongly support B, because if you think of the case of a large corporation, having the corporation's email address must be collected does not make nearly as much sense as saying you must collect an address for contact related to the use of the domain, related to the domain name. So I think it applies in a case like that where the first wording just doesn't apply at all. Having IBM's generic email address is not the same as being able to contact someone for the domain. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. So is there would there be anybody opposed to accepting B as our tentative conclusion at this point in time? And if so, could you explain why? Okay. No objections then to doing that? All right, let's use B at this stage, and we will move on from there to the next question. Question six, and again, there are a couple alternatives on six. The first one in green is, in addition to email addresses, data enabling one alternative method of contact must be collected and included in the RDS. And then an alternative to that was data enabling one or more alternative or preferred methods of contact may also be optionally collected and included in the RDS. Now, there are several differences in those two key statements that I'm sure I don't need to explain to you. One of them is there's a must in the green one, and there's not a it's optional in the blue, and in the blue it talks about one or more, a couple of the differences there. So let me first of all, and you can see the results, pretty good support for B. But I've also heard some people say that, you know, in our discussion so far, not just on this question, that you know, it might be a good idea to require an alternative method. We just talked about that when we were talking about the previous question. So let me open it up for discussion on this and hear what members have to say. Michele, start it off, please.
Yeah, thanks. I'm not, Michele, for the record, I'm not 100% sure whether requiring an alternative contact method is really within our purview. I mean, you know, it addresses a particular need and requirement in another realm. I'm just not 100% sure whether it really deals with what we're dealing with, if that makes sense. I mean, in terms of, you know, an a SSAC recommendation on good domain name management, it would make perfect sense to me. But in terms of discussing the policy around a replacement for Whois, I'm not sure that it really does. Now, I could be convinced otherwise, but I'm just not 100% convinced.
Thanks, Michele. Chuck again. Greg, you're up. Greg Shatton.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. Sorry I did not participate in the poll. The weekend was a mess for good reason. But in any case, I think neither of these alternatives are really ones that I would line up behind. What I would have liked to have seen is one that said that in addition to email address, data enabling two alternative methods of contact must be collected and included in the RDS. We have the at least, we have one or more in the second one. We only have the optional, so we did not get kind of the third combination, which is to have two alternative methods, which is also the status quo. As noted by the other Greg, when I'm not the other Greg, in the notes, and I think that I would disagree with Michele. I'm not sure I can be persuasive right off the top of my head, but I do think that contactability is part of of who is and thus should be part of RDS. And as we've noted so far in our conversation, email can fail, and it's good to have other modes of communication so that you can get there somehow. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Would you do us a favor and write your third alternative in the chat so that we have it in writing there? We'll continue pursuing this further, but it'd be nice to see it in writing. Stephanie, your turn.
Thanks very much, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. My initial urge to put my hand up was we can't manage every possible risk in terms of contacting the registrant. You know, umpteen emails could fill, the phone could be out, who knows. I'm just wondering exactly what risks are we undertaking to manage? It seems to me they should be tightly wound up with the security and stability of the Internet. So, obviously, if the domain is acting up as in the example cited, a phone number or an address would help us track that person down. Secondly, we are not talking about publishing this data. We're talking about the data that has to be collected and in the RDS somewhere. So in a tiered access system, it's not necessarily reachable. What we have not talked about is the differentiation between data that we insist on being in the RDS and data that we could separately insist that registrars through their contract collect. And I'm just wondering if that isn't one way of handling some of these risks. If at the end of the day the email isn't working and nobody's answering the phone, if I know the registrar, I'm going to contact the registrar. And if the registrar had to have an alternative method of contacting, and Michele says they obviously already do, but you might want to mandate that for the registrars that are not as good as Michele is, that don't show up at ICANN meetings, you could handle it that way. But it all gets tied down to just exactly how much of the risk management of this entire system are we willing to take on. Thanks.
So thanks, Stephanie. This is Chuck. So a follow-up question. So if I hear at least part of what you're saying, you're suggesting that alternative means of communications could be required in policy for registrars to obtain and not necessarily put it in the RDS. Did I get that right?
Exactly. Thank
okay.
you.
Oh, no, you're welcome. Thanks for the input. Alan, you're next.
Thank you very much. We cannot address every possible risk. As Stephanie points out, the phone system can go down. All sorts of things can happen in disaster situations or even in semi-normal situations. But email is a rather special case. We know people change emails on a regular basis. We know email fails. Just in terms of reliability, you know, sometimes the messages from ICANN's mailing list get to me. Occasionally they don't. So email is a special case that has a particularly high risk associated with it working, and I think mandating that a valid email address be collected is something that we do want to augment with an additional method of communication. The concept, I haven't thought about it very much, because I hadn't thought of it until Stephanie just mentioned, but the concept of requiring a registrar to keep specific information, but that is not placed in the RDS, doesn't sound right to me. That sounds like talking about their business practices as opposed to something that ICANN should have control over. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Chuck again. Andrew.
Hi. Thanks. Twice in this discussion, people have said, once in the chat and simply just now, that there's this idea of requiring the registrars to collect something, but it's not in the RDS. And I guess I'm a little mystified what people mean by that, because it seems to me that if what we're doing is we're requiring that registrars collect some piece of data, then in some sense it is in the RDS. That's what this thing is. It's a distributed database that includes the things that are collected about registrars. And so there's a distinction here that people are making that I think I don't understand. Maybe I've overlooked something in our documentation, but I maybe somebody could explain to me what the distinction is that they've got in mind. Thanks.
Before I respond, let's see if others can respond to that. McKaylee?
Thanks, Chuck. That's actually why I put up my hand. Okay, I think I can understand why there might be a little bit of a confusion around this. If you go through the policies and the contracts, there's a lot. For example, there's stuff around payments. And if a registrar is subject to an audit, certain things around payments may be requested by ICANN, but at no time would we ever transmit or share that kind of information with an RDS. It doesn't go into who is, but it is information that we collect. There's also various things about IP addresses to do with various transactions, etc., etc. Again, as the registrar, we have the data, but we're not putting that into RDS or any replacement of it. I mean, there's a ton of information that we would have about our clients that have nothing to do with who is or its replacement. Now, if there is an issue, be that something which is some potential breach of a contractual condition, that that it might be covered in some part of the contract, but it doesn't mean that we're going to put that into an RDS. I don't know, does that help?
Andrew, you're welcome to respond to Michaela's question.
Okay, so that's why I put my hand up. Thanks. It's Andrew again. It does help, but I guess the thing that's troubling me a little bit is that we decided to talk not just about things that we publish and who is in the traditional way, but once we had this idea that we were also going to talk about all the stuff that's collected and whether we're going to collect it, quote, in the RDS. I guess my view is that what that essentially means is anything you collect is in some sense in the RDS, and now it's just a question of who is allowed to view it and who isn't. And so in the case of stuff about payments, for instance, nobody outside of the parties involved in the payment are allowed to see that information, except under cases of audit, and in that case the auditors are allowed to, and of course under court order and so on. But it's part of the RDS just as surely as name server information is, since we've decided to include all of the stuff that we're collecting in the RDS. At least that's the way I view it. So I guess I'm just trying to maybe what we're trying to say, and the distinction that you're trying to make, if I understood you correctly, is stuff that could conceivably be a candidate for somebody aside from the registrar and the registrant to see, versus everything else. Is that the distinction you're making?
I think I can understand where you're coming from, and I understand how you got there. But there's two parts to this. One part is that although information may be collected and processed in relation to the management of a domain, be that the registration, transfer, update, et cetera, under the current system, there's a ton of information that is made publicly available with no kind of checks or anything. I mean, anybody can access it pretty much. Within the paradigm of an RDS, that there would be some level of gating, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, for example, if you fit into a particular category, you would get access to more information. I mean, details of that we haven't fully discussed, but that's where some of that came from. When it comes to things like payment information and all that, realistic. I think that's where there's a bit of confusion. And I'm not sure whether that's being caused by us or by, I don't know, something else. It's you know, as the, if you, I suppose if you think about it in terms of your day-to-day dealings with anybody, I mean, you exchange emails with somebody, but if you know somebody in person and you've actually hung out with them, you'd know that while that person may have very strong feelings about X, Y, and Z, they also happen to have a penchant for Scotch whiskey. And the only reason you know that is because you're hanging out with them. And the same way with a registrar and hosting provider, we have a ton of information related to our clients that falls well outside the purview of who is or its replacement. Some of it might fall under the purview of a contractual obligation or some kind of policy obligation that exists within ICANN's purview, but outside of the Who Is Accuracy RDS stuff. I don't know if that helps you at all.
Okay, so this is Chuck. I'm going to jump in now. We're not going to resolve this question in this meeting, okay? Those that have the hands up, I'm going to give you a chance to talk, so you don't need to take your hands down. I'm just going to ask you to keep it within a minute or so that we can move on to question 7, and then I want to have enough time for another important item on the agenda. Let me make clear, we're not done with this one yet, I don't know. I've been busy listening and not watching the chat. So, Greg, I don't know if you ever put your third alternative in there, but if you haven't, please do that. And then we will let me let Alan, Michael, and Stephanie and Tim, thanks for jumping back in, Tim, because you hadn't said anything yet. That would be great for you to do it. Try and keep it within a minute or so that we can move on to another topic, understanding that we're going to have to spend more time on this one in the list and in and then in future meeting or two. So, Alan, you're up.
Thank you very much. Alan Greenberg speaking. I think Andrew is suggesting that we define the RDS as anything that is collected, and that's a rat's nest that is even larger than the one we're already in, and I would avoid that like the plague for all the reasons that McKaylee gave and other people on the in the chat. You know, among other things, registrars may keep historic information of what it was last week, even though it's changed now. That's not necessarily something that we want to put in the RDS. In any particular case, it might be, and we may want to deliberate on that. But there's a huge amount of information that is associated with domain names that might be discoverable on a court order, but certainly I don't think belong in the RDS. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Michael.
Thank you, Michael Hammer, for the record. So really, I think it's somewhat easy to divide this into clear buckets. So there is information collected for the RDS, whether or not it's published. We keep on getting hung up on the published part. There are things that are collected under RAA, which is a contractual agreement between ICANN, the registries, and the registrars. And then there is additional things that a registrar may choose to collect as part of their agreement with their customer that is beyond either RDS or RAA, unless it's specifically precluded by RAA. And if we think about it that way, I think it makes it easier to deal with questions like what was on the survey. That's all I got.
Thanks, Michael. Stephanie.
Thanks, Stephanie Perrin, for the record.
predictably enough, I'm going to remind everybody that the purpose of collection from a data protection perspective goes back to who the controller is. And there's a very strict limit. ICANN can set itself up as a controller insisting be collected and put into a directory service, an RDS, that could be available to a global population. That's pretty limited. It has to follow the rules. And I'll repeat some of the arguments that I made back in the EWG days. There's no way that I can see that the financial information, the payment information, which of course is essential if you're investigating a crime, should be under the control of ICANN, i.e. under this, in this system. So that bright line between the, what the registrar has and what ICANN controls through its contracts has to be maintained, or we're going to be in one heck of a mess. Thanks.
Thank you, Stephanie, and this is Chuck, and I'm just going to insert one comment. You recall that the data protection experts and their responses to our questions pointed out that there could be joint controllers, okay? So a registrar and ICANN, for example, could be joint controllers, and it's my understanding that their purposes might be different for particular data elements. So just wanted to point that out from information we received from the data protection officer. Tim, you're up.
Good morning, everyone. Tim O'Brien for the record. It looks like we'll be eating these dead horses for a while, and I can appreciate that. Let me also highlight that in third world countries, in certain rural areas here in the United States, there potentially could be problems with communication, or that organization may not even exist anymore. And for independent malware researchers, independent security researchers trying to get in touch with organizations to let them know that their old website that hasn't been taken down is spewing malware or is being used for command and control, that can get a little frustrating, to say the least, when even though you've reached out to the registrar or the hosting provider and they won't talk to you, it's still compromising systems in your organization. And I had one situation just a couple months ago of a old brewery website out in the Carolinas here in the United States, where the only way I was able to get, we were able to get in touch with them was finding the guy's LinkedIn profile and reaching out. So as we can't come up with, you know, every outlier situation, but we need to come up with some way that here's the information and it's for legitimate purposes and we're helping protect the sanctity and the ability to communicate over the Internet.
Thanks, Tim. And I want to cut this item off. Mark, are you still wanting to talk about this same item?
I was going to make a comment sort of on question 5 and 6 combined.
Okay.
I don't know if it fits into where you're going.
Keep it brief, please.
Sure. I think that, you know, I've mentioned this on previous calls. I think contactability is important. And looking at question 5 and 6, you know, in on the whole, you know, my opinion is that, you know, it's important to have one primary method of contactability, and for all the reasons people have mentioned, there should be at least one alternative method of contact, you know, which may or may not be email. But sort of looking at 5 and 6 on the whole, you know, that's sort of, you know, my opinion on where we should go with that. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. And what I'm going to suggest, and this will be an action item for the leadership team to take, is that we try and come up with a question or two on this particular item that deals with some of the things that have been brought up and put it into a poll so that we can kind of motivate some ongoing thinking and follow up with that next week. So that'll be an action item for us as a leadership team. On that, and very quickly, let's go to question 7. If you want to scroll down there, this one's an easier one, I think. So the key concept is at least one element enabling contact must be based on an open standard and not a proprietary communication method. And those who were on the call last week or listened to the recording, you'll recall that this came out of that meeting, and Andrew made some good points on this one. Again, we have pretty strong support here, no disagreement. So I'm going to suggest that we accept that as a tentative conclusion with at least rough consensus at this point in the game and add it to our list of such things. And are there any objections to that? Stephanie, is that an old hand? Okay, thanks. All right. If not, then we will accept that as a tentative conclusion. And I then want to go to the next item on the agenda, which is item 2C, which is deliberate on key concepts for registrant email address and other contact methods. I'm sorry, it's 2D. I'm on the wrong one. Deliberate on roles that were broadly supported in our a poll, 3 weeks ago or so. Admin, tech, abuse, privacy proxy, and we're going to add to that the other two that were suggested in the EWG report. And what we're going to do now is I'm going to turn it over to Rod Rasmussen. He's made a presentation at the leadership team request to on the contact approach suggested in the EWG report, and it's pretty involved. So I encourage you to not only pay attention on this, but be prepared to ask questions. Now, just one little alert, okay, and why I wanted to have as much time as possible for this one today. My understanding is Rod's not going to be with us the next couple weeks, next couple meetings. So if you have questions, note them, and we'll try and fit them in today if we have time. Now, there are other people on the who are on the EWG that are part of our team, and we're not going to just rely on Rod for responses, but to the extent possible, let's take advantage of the fact that he is with us this week. Rod, it's over to you. Thanks.
Thanks, Chuck. Rod Rasmussen here. So I've pulled together some from various sources and slide decks that we put together. I should say we, Lisa and the staff, put together mainly during the EWG process a few years ago. And from those presentations, tried to cull down to this core concept that I've been talking about here for the last few calls around what these purpose-based contacts look like, and really this idea of separating contact objects or the idea of the data around contacts from the domain registration itself and making that a linked type of thing. And so there were a lot of presentations that were given during the various ICANN meetings and then information pulled together as part of support for FAQs and other things that we did to try and explain some of these things. So I've taken, I don't know, probably about 30 or 40 slides and condensed it down into, I think, 7 or 8. And if we can move to slide 2, I'll get into what I'm talking about. But the idea here is to try and get people on the same page as far as how we treat these things from a conceptual basis, because I think it solves a lot of problems, both from a policy perspective and a design perspective, as far as being able to support this, these kinds of things. I don't know who's driving the slides. Could I have slide 2, please? Thank you. There we go. Okay, now it's showing it properly on mine. So we already talked about the different types of contacts, and that's what this topic area is. I don't want to get too far into this, but the idea is that, you know, you have these different roles, and those roles have different responsibilities attached to them, and they may have different requirements attached to them as far as the information that may be published publicly versus various gates versus being required for somebody to collect and maintain, right? And we don't have to make decisions about those immediately, but the idea here is really around the framework for how we do this so that we can, in fact, say that for if we define what a abuse contact is or a business contact is or whatever, you know, pick your favorite kind of type of contact, then roles and responsibilities can be debated around that, and then how that is collected and displayed are also tied to those roles and responsibilities rather than as this kind of carte blanche, everything is the same perspective that the current WHOIS system has. I have the next slide, please. Okay, and this diagram here kind of gives you the idea of what we're talking about here. So you have a domain name that's going to have a registrant at the very least, and that registrant may designate multiple contacts to provide the required or necessary fulfillment of the roles that those different types of contacts have. There is no requirement for there to be anything but one contact for a domain necessarily, because the registrant themselves can handle all those roles if they so choose, right? It's not that we have to fill out 10 different pieces of contact information, full sets of data for 10 different contacts or 20 different contacts or whatever it is. It's the idea is that if you have responsibilities that you want to divvy up to other people to have them handle things for you, for example, your ISP or web hosting firm to handle all technical issues for you, you can so designate them. And that is linked from the domain name to the ID. If you are old timer Nick handle, or come up with whatever kind of key you want to as far as the connector goes, doesn't really matter. The idea is that you have this basically pointer to another contact object, which is can be maintained by the contact themselves. We'll go into that in just a second. But the idea being that as a name is designated, modified, et cetera, you do not necessarily have to update contact information associated with a particular domain name. And my apologies if you're hearing some background noise. I've got a contractor working on my house today and just fired up a saw, so hopefully it won't be too loud. I was just saying the idea here is that the domain information can be changed, things like name server, things like that, or even registrant data can be changed, but you don't have to change everything necessarily, and that's across all the domain names you may be associated with. Can I have the next slide, please? So this one is an interesting comparison of where we are today, which everything is in at the top is the current system. Everything is in green because it's all public. All that information has to be collected and maintained for every single domain name there is. Some registrars have gotten clever about doing that and still have their back-end systems. If you enter it once, you can just reuse it again. I will point out, ironically, that back in the day, prior to ICANN, when Network Solutions was running everything, they had this concept called a NIC handle. And you'd fill in your information once, and you would get your NIC handle. And that information could be used for any domain that Network Solutions happened to be responsible for, which used to be all GTLDs. So you could, in fact, make a modification to, say, the address if you moved. I know I did this at least once. And that would be reflected across all the domain names that I happen to have, whether it was com.org, I think that was it at the time. I couldn't get an EDU, for example, but com.org were the big three. And so those you could, you know, because they had a system where the ostensibly, I wasn't at Network Solutions, so I'm not sure what the database actually looked like, but from the outside, it looked like they collected and created an object and they tied it to the domain names that it was actually designated for and in the various roles, because you had the four classic roles of registrant, admin, tech, and billing were the four. classic roles. So this is what I'm talking about, is a little bit of back to the future in a way how we were doing things. So, Network Solutions was the registry for everything, and they were the registrar for everything. So it made it a little bit easier, but the idea was pretty straightforward. That's the top. The bottom is kind of how the AWG proposed doing this going forward, which is you would have data around domain names, the things we've already talked about, like the registration date and the name servers and stuff like that, as the existing kind of domain name data that's domain specific. And then you would have a registrant ID with, depending on where you put your policy, different information being publicly available or not, and then other information behind a gate. Those are all decisions that have to be made from a policy perspective. But again, you have that information collected there. And then you have these purpose-based contacts, which are optional, but would then, again, different information could be displayed in different situations for different use cases and for different purposes, in either publicly and or via gate or some other methodology. So the idea there is that you have this connector between the domain and those contacts. And those contacts, the people who have those contacts manage their own data. Again, you as a domain holder, you can manage your registrant identification, but if you designate a purpose-based contact to somebody else, some other entity, say it's your web hosting provider, say it's your proxy provider, say it's some legal representative you want to have handling various things for you, whatever it is, right? Those entities, individuals or organizations, manage their data, right? And then you provide the connector between them. That raises some questions around that we talked about on the list last week around getting permission to be or from those contacts to handle those roles. And we actually talked about that at length. But the system allows you to do some kind of back and forth validation and verification around the concept that as an ISP, I'm responsible for the technical as a technical contact for this domain name, for example. Things like that can be automated, and they can also this allows you to as a contact say, I'm not interested in being that role anymore. I'm going to say I do not provide that permission, and then the domain registrant would have to find somebody else to handle that role for them. So for example, if you were to change your hosting provider, you couldn't list your old hosting provider as your technical contact if he does not wish to be it anymore, for example. Okay. Next slide, please. Now it's getting really loud in here. Okay. So this is these are a couple of examples of what the data looks like. These are various fields. And again, this is what we proposed in the EWG. We may come up with different proposals here, but each one of these is a contact. And for the role that it is assumed, you may disclose different information publicly versus behind a gate versus some other method. Right. So if I'm taking on a proxy provider role as one of these, and another one is a business one, I can have the same contact information, but different things may be displayed or publicly displayed or available via a certain purpose based on the role I happen to be playing for that particular domain name. And that's an important concept to remember. This basically takes the information you provide, you submit that once, and then it's the way it's collected once, but then it's displayed based on the purpose and the role that you're actually playing, rather than it's just displayed or not displayed. All right, so this allows you a lot of flexibility in how you do this. Next slide, please. I want to make sure we get through this so we get any questions. So here's what this ends up kind of looking like for different use cases here. We've got three different ones. Where one, you have a person who signed up for their own domain name, and they don't have any of these other special things. They're just going to list themselves for all their contacts. So basically the registrant contact fills all the roles. So if you need to get a hold of somebody for abuse, well, you get the information from the registrant that would be published for abuse. If you need to get a hold of somebody for, well, you wouldn't have a proxy provider or a business contact in this particular case because you have an individual person. The middle one has that same person, but they decided to use a proxy provider, right? And they decided to use their ISP as their technical contact because they, if anything that comes up that is of a technical nature, things are broken, things are spewing spam, whatever. Let the that's abuse contact, but for technical issues, get a hold of my ISP, then they'll take care of it for you. Other than that, go through the proxy provider. So that's the kind of middle case. And the third case on the right is a business that wants to provide a full suite of different contacts for different issues. And again, you have the different roles there. And those roles will likely in a business be handled by somebody within that organization, but not necessarily. I mean, for example, I still have an ISP handle things that are, because I'm hosting, an Amazon Cloud Services or something like that, and I want to, any issues to go bug them about it. Or I may have outside legal counsel or something like that where I want to designate a different contact. Okay, so those are kind of how that ends up being in practice is what it looks like. How do we get there? That's the next slide, please. Yeah. Oh, nope. One back. There we go. Registrant contact creation. So there's two parts to contacts. One is you got to create them in the first place. Well, actually, there's three parts. There's the creation of contacts. There's the creation of a domain name or the designation of a contact for the domain name. And then there's modification. And we'll talk about modification in a minute. But basically, the idea here is that you would, as a person, entity, organization that is going to have information associated with domain names, you would create a contact. Now, in the EWG report, we talked about validators, which may or may not be registrars, but they would be some organization you would work with that you would provide your information to, and they would enter it into the system. We envision that registrars would be validators, but there could be other local, like law firms or other entities that might provide these services, especially when you have data protection differences amongst different countries, et cetera. You may go to a local place to enter this information. Remember that the information in the RDS is a pointer from a domain is a pointer to a contact. So while we were talking about a centralized database for the RDS or the EWG, this paradigm and framework allows you to actually store data locally and then retrieve it based on queries. So keep that in mind. But anyways, you would use a validator or a registrar. I can even imagine some of the registries wanting to be validators because that's part of their business model, that would provide this service for you. And you can do, there's a whole bunch of stuff we haven't gotten to around a validation, authentication, all that good stuff that this supports really nicely, which I'll put to the side. We can come back to that later. When you create a domain name, you then designate the contacts you want for the various roles if you want to put a different contact in other than yourself as a registrant. You can either, the process for doing that, there's lots of different ways you can do that. If you're a registrar, you may automate the whole process because you're going to be the contacts for technical issues and things like that. It's kind of what happens today at some registrars or hosting companies that are resellers for registrars. I see that happening a lot. Another thing you can do is provide, if you purchase services from that registrar or from that ISP or something like that, you can get an authorization code from them to designate them as a contact. Or you could have a notification process where if I say, hey, I want contact XYZ123 to be my business contact or pick whatever contact you feel like, then they would get a notification saying, hey, domain X is requesting you as this contact, do you accept that? So there's lots of different processes you can do to actually validate the fact that this contact is the one that's supposed to be handling that role and then allow them to opt out later. And that gets to the last slide here, which is, I think it's the last slide, which is, can you move to the next slide? There we go. Nope, I'm sorry, that slide right there. So you use these, you can use these validators, think of them as registrars right now or whatever, however you want to think about it, is they're the organizations and the websites you go into and say, hey, I want to modify my information. And if I need to change my phone number or my email address or my a LinkedIn account name or whatever I'm using as contact information, I do that once. And for every domain with every role that I'm associated with, that information is, in theory, automatically updated. So I don't have to do that for the 10,000 domain names I happen to host as a ISP or a web hosting company. This problem has come up, and it's been mentioned to me actually several times over just the last couple of months. There's a lot of interest in this, but it's a long-standing problem. Back in the day, as I said, when it was just network solutions, this was really easy. I did this more than once myself. I just updated it, and it all worked. I believe, and I know there's some, you know, there will be an interesting discussion to talk about how we can do this on an inter-registry, inter-registrar basis, but it is technically possible. It is, the question is whether it's, you know, whether it's the will to do it. But it solves a lot of these issues. And again, it gets back to, I can now control who gets to use my information and what roles they use it, which by policy means that depending on the roles I agree to, that information may or may not be available publicly or via gates and things like that, depending on how we define the policy. So it fairly elegantly solves a lot of the issues that right now, because everything's domain-centric rather than domain and contact-centric, we run into, because we keep saying, oh, we're going to define this for per domain, and that means all that information gets entered in for that domain name, and it's kind of sitting there. And the person who or organization who it's representing may or may not be happy about that. So the next slide was a bonus slide. We've only got like 12 minutes left, and this is kind of there's this. You can look at this up. This is kind of our set of what the minimum public data might look like, which is the set of domain information, some of the registrant information, and then contact IDs. It's basically the concept there. So that is the 7 or 8 slides that I boiled that down to, and I have not been able to follow all the questions, so I will shut up now and let Chuck run the queue of however people want to.
Thanks a lot, Rod, not only for giving this presentation, but for preparing it. And thanks to the EWG for all the work they did on this, because it's something I think we might be able to take advantage of in part or maybe in full. Let's leave the last slide up there for a little bit, number 9, just because it has a lot of detail and people can kind of look at that. If somebody wants to go back to another slide when they ask their question, we can do that. So everybody has scroll control again. So if you'd like to look at the data on slide 9, just what the minimum public data might look like under this model, I said might, okay, then take a look at that slide. I'm going to open it up for Q&A. Now, we've only got about 10 minutes, so let's be as concise as we can, both in questions and in responses. I'm sure we're going to have to spend a lot more time on this, but let's take advantage of Rod's presence here. And if others in the EWG want to jump in too, that's certainly welcome. Let's start with Maxim.
Maxim Alzoba, for the record. My biggest concern here is if we create, hypothetically, a unique database of registrant IDs, when IDs are not issued by particular registries, like it's done now with the ROIDs of registrar IDs or something, then we will have to identify identity of the person. For example, I want to register one domain one day and the next domain next day, and most probably they should be have the same registrant ID. And the only possibility to identify then that it's me is to like see my passport or ID or whatsoever. Registrars passed through this issue many times when forged documents were made to get someone else's domains. So it's not a new idea. And it leads us to creation of the database full of IDs, and it's way, way beyond what we need in DNS. Thanks.
And thank you, Maxim. And Rod, you don't need to raise your hand every time you want to respond, and I will give you opportunity to respond first if you'd like to in each case. So would you like to respond to that?
Yes, thanks, Chuck. This is Rod again. Those are valid concerns. I don't think I don't know if there's any system that can solve the particular problem that was just described, because you can always create, and actually there's nothing saying you can't create multiple IDs, even for yourself, to manage things. You know, let's say you had a small business and you wanted to manage things that way, and you also have personal stuff you want to manage differently. You can create different identities for that and different contacts for that. I think there's actually legitimate uses for that particular one. This is all around the ease of being able to do that. So I've got, let's say, two or three personalities that I would want to manage or be involved with domain names under. I can create those few contacts, but if I'm managing 100 domain names, or in the case of businesses, you know, tens of thousands of domain names, then, you know, I don't want to make tens of thousands of different contacts, right? And, oh, by the way, you end up with a lot of different inaccuracies just because people type the things differently on different days and stuff like that. Then also, you don't necessarily, there's a whole, I mean, we haven't gotten to the validation and authentication section yet, but there's a whole section there on that we talked about in EWG around different levels of validation. You could just create a contact and have, like, say, a working email address, or actually you just create a contact. And just submit it. You don't necessarily have to validate it to use it, but you would label that based on that scheme as, you know, basically unconfirmed, unvalidated. It's syntactically correct is all we know, right? That that's an email. It looks like an email address. It looks like a phone number, et cetera, et cetera. That's where we are today, for the most part. And this gets back into some of the stuff we talked about in out of SAC as well, different levels of validation. You could actually have the contacts, if you, you know, follow that scheme, have a different level of validation based on, yes, with actually the email and the phone number actually works and some of the answers. It's a different level of validation. Then you can say, then if you really want to, you can have, like, submit your business license or your passport or whatever and get, like, super validation. Yes, this looks like it really is that person. You know, again, though, if people use stolen documents and things like that, there's always that, you know, we have that same problem in the real world with people opening phony businesses and using stolen documents or forged documents. We're not going to solve that problem. But you can at least provide a mechanism for people who want to provide that level of information and assurance, particularly in thinking about business here, that ability to add that kind of information and those kinds of signals, if you will, to folks who are using the system and say, okay, that's probably who I think it is using that. So that's where we went with that. Thanks.
And Rod, a question that I think is kind of related to that was asked by Volker in the chat, and he had to leave early. But he said, I am worried about the registrant ID field. That being public would allow anyone to figure out the complete set of domains owned by a registrant, and that may allow cross-referencing detective work. I don't know if you want
right.
to add.
So, yeah. My answer to that is, yeah, yes, it will, absolutely, and that's actually one of the things that us in the abuse community want. However, if you are concerned about that, and, you know, there's always a way to game the system, just use a different registrant contact every time. That means if you're a legitimate person, you actually have to handle tracking that. If you only have three domains, it doesn't matter. If you have 3,000 domains, well, that's a pain. So it really depends on who you're trying to protect yourself from. Right. I would posit that most people who have cross references and are worried about cross references is probably are doing something that us abuse folks might be interested in. But there certainly could be legitimate uses where you don't want to have people cross reference. And, you know, then you go with what we do in the current system, which is every domain has its own unique contact, basically. And there's no preclusion. You're not precluded from doing that by the system. You just have to manage it yourself.
Thanks, Rod. Michael, you're next.
Thank you. Michael Hammer for the record. So looking at the minimum public data on that slide, so this forces any contacts to go through the registrar. Would that be a correct statement, Rod?
Or a validator.
Or a validator. Okay, so one, a lot of times when there's a problem and it's a, let's call it a, an innocent third party, a lot of times I'll look at the registration, find another way of reaching them, that is look up their phone number, whatever, because they've been compromised. This means that because that's not possible to do, and I think this is a consideration folks need to have, and Rod, you said you're part of the abuse community. I really think you mean anti-abuse community, but be that as it may. I think what you're going to find is a lot more just going, it's not worth trying to reach out, you know, and go the extra distance. Put people on RBLs, block them, drop, route, whatever. So I really think people need to think about, you know, be careful what you ask for. You just might get it.
Yeah, can I go out? I'll respond to that if that's all right, Chuck.
Yeah, just briefly, because we're just about out of time.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah, and okay, so yes, I'm a member of the abuse community when it comes to you, Michael. But other than that, anti-abuse. No, I'm just kidding. I was debating whether to put this slide in at all. What's in or out of the public data set, we have to decide. This is not set in stone. This is the recommendation we came up with. And we also provided for mechanisms through via the gated access to get a hold of exactly the information we're talking about. We're not talking about that right now. What we're talking about is basically at least what I'm talking about is this framework. The framework supports, you know, we could say, hey, all the data has to be public. It doesn't matter. From that perspective, what I'm trying to get, though, is the idea that